This morning's reading is by the Reverend Dr. Rebecca Ann Parker, Choose to Bless the World. Your gifts, whatever you discover them to be, can be used to bless or curse the world. The mind's power, the strength of the hands, the reaches of the heart, the gift of speaking, listening, imagining, seeing, waiting, any of these can serve to feed the hungry, bind up wounds, welcome the stranger, praise what is sacred, do the work of justice, or offer love. Any of these can draw down the prison door, hoard bread, abandon the poor, obscure what is holy, comply with injustice, or withhold love. You must answer this question: what will you do with your gifts? Choose to bless the world. The choice to bless the world can take you into solitude to search for the sources of power and grace, native wisdom, healing, and liberation. More, the choice will draw you into community, the endeavor shared, the heritage passed on, the companionship of struggle, the importance of keeping faith. The life of ritual and praise, the comfort of human friendship, the company of earth, the chorus of life welcoming you. None of us alone can save the world. Together, that is another possibility waiting. The choice to bless the world is more than an act of will, a moving forward into the world with the intention to do good. It is an act of recognition, a confession of surprise, a grateful acknowledgement that in the midst of a broken world, unspeakable beauty, grace, and mystery abound. There is an embrace of kindness that encompasses all life, even yours. And while there is injustice, anesthetization, or evil, there moves a holy disturbance, a benevolent rage, a revolutionary love, protesting, urging, insisting. That which is sacred will not be defiled. Those who bless the world live their life as a gesture of thanks for this beauty and this rage. Good morning. It is wonderful. It is wonderful to be here with all of you today and this weekend celebrating this joyous celebration of the life of this community. This morning, I'd like to talk about why Unitarian Universalists love institutions so much and how we can use that love to bless the world. Please hear me clearly. This is not a sermon about why we ought to love institutions. My claim is that we do love institutions, and my invitation is to think about how we might make best use of that love. My claim may surprise you. We Unitarian Universalists like to think of ourselves as individualists or rebels. Many of us have rejected the religious institutions in which we grew up. Like Ralph Waldo Emerson, we seek to free ourselves from the trammels of tradition and become acquainted at first hand with the divine. Like Henry David Thoreau, we aspire to follow the beat of a different drummer. But Emerson left the Unitarian ministry, and Thoreau took the extra step of writing his congregation a special letter saying he didn't want to be a member anymore. They are not our true fathers in faith, only our eccentric uncles. Our real ancestors were Emerson's and Thoreau's friends and admirers, even their sisters and daughters, who heard what they had to say, but kept on showing up at church Sunday after Sunday. So I invite you to think about why you keep on coming, or why, if this is your first time, you chose to check this church out today. All of you are here now. Some of you were here last Sunday and the Sunday before and the Sunday before. Quite a few of you chose to spend the last two nights sleeping at this church. I ask you, why? you probably don't imagine that regular attendance at this church is a ticket to heaven. I can only speak for myself, but I still can't quite shake the nagging worry that hanging out at Unitarian Universalist churches might keep me out of heaven. But here we are all the same. You probably aren't here out of sheer habit because you can't imagine anything else to do on a beautiful Sunday morning. Most of us have had periods in our lives when we didn't attend worship regularly, but for some reason we came back or came for the first time and stayed. And you aren't here because you never heard an argument against church going. Perhaps you've even heard Emerson's famous account of a boring service he once attended in Concord, Massachusetts. "People go where they are wont to go," he recalled, "else had no soul entered the temple that afternoon. A snowstorm was falling around us. The snowstorm was real. The preacher merely spectral." Perhaps, back in the days before Gretchen and Sean arrived at this church, some of you might have heard a sermon or two that was less interesting than a snowstorm. Some of you might be hearing such a sermon right now. But for some reason, you've kept on choosing sermons over snowstorms. Most likely, you are all too aware of the way that institutions can reinforce and magnify the social injustices of racism, sexism, ableism, class privilege, and others. The current struggle over hiring practices in the UUA that some of you may have heard about is evidence both of the capacity of institutions to carry the very injustices they are struggling against and of the capacity of Unitarian Universalists to criticize and mistrust our institutions. But it's also evidence of our stubborn hope that somehow, some way, our institutions might become better than they are now. Obviously, I don't know the exact motives that brought each of you here today, but I invite you to consider the possibility that you just happen to be in love with the church as an institution. That love might not be entirely rational. Your mind might be a Thoreauvian rebel, but look around and you see that your bottom is in a chair at church. If you are like me, you love institutions with body and soul, even against your better judgment. If that's your situation, the next question is not why, but what next? What can you, as someone who loves institutions even against your better judgment, do to bless the world? This is an urgent question today. All institutions in our society are going through tough times. 2 decades ago, conservative churches were growing and liberal churches were shrinking. Now religious participation in the United States is declining across the board. Fewer and fewer Americans are willing to identify with either of the major political parties. Membership in labor unions is half what it was a generation ago. The United States government is currently controlled by people who make no secret of their disdain for government. And that paradox is not unique to the United States. Last summer's Brexit vote and the upcoming national elections in France call into question the survival of all the institutions that were created to restore global peace in the wake of the Second World War. Times like this, what should lovers of institutions do? It would be tempting to say, let's fight to defend our institutions. But I think that's the wrong impulse. Institutions often live longer than human beings, but no institution is immortal. Perhaps some of the institutions we have loved will need to die in our lifetime in order for new institutions to rise and take their place. If so, our first task is to make sure that the institutions we have now are seedbeds for the institutions that will hold our future. Luckily for us, this is what Unitarian Universalists have always done. When changing circumstances render old institutions dysfunctional, We've stepped forward with creative ideas about new institutions. The school where I teach, Harvard Divinity School, was founded 200 years ago by Unitarian ministers who believed that their newly democratic nation needed a new form of ministry. They created a school that made free inquiry the foundation of ministerial identity because they believed that the minister's first duty was, in William Ellery Channing's words, to bring about a great revolution in the world. Two generations later, the rest of Harvard realized that its classical curriculum, emphasizing the study of ancient languages, was not serving a future that would be shaped by scientific research. Harvard President Charles Eliot had grown up in the stodgiest and oldest Unitarian congregation in Boston, but he was the one who expanded Harvard's laboratories and reformed the curriculum to allow students to study whatever topics they judged most important. Elsewhere, Unitarians helped launch other research universities like Stanford, Berkeley, and Cornell. During the greatest institutional crisis of the 20th century, Unitarians and Universalists helped create the New Deal and the global institutions that are now experiencing a new crisis. Among these folks were the sisters Martha and Abby Elliott, whose brother Fred served as president of the Unitarian denomination. Abby was a pioneer in the nursery school movement, while Martha and her life partner, Ethel Dunham, worked for the Federal Children's Bureau, where they ensured that care for vulnerable children would become part of the Social Security system. After the Second World War, Martha took those same values global, helping to found UNICEF and the World Health Organization. Another Unitarian New Dealer was Aurelia Reinhart, who served as president of Mills College in Oakland and as the first female moderator of the American Unitarian Association. Like Abby Elliott, Reinhart embraced the child-centered educational philosophies of John Dewey. A staunch defender of public education, she insisted that public schools would create democratic citizens only if they were willing to undergo continuous transformation in response to the changing needs of children. So many 20th century Unitarian Universalists did this work because they believed that the care of institutions was religious work. Democracy, said Minister A. Powell Davies, is its own religion, worthy of the same devotion that more conventionally religious people pour into worship of God. Ethicist James Luther Adams pointed out that self-governing local congregations, places that ordain their own ministers, are laboratories of democracy, where people learn to be active citizens. That's why so many Unitarians and Universalists devoted their lives to the work of organizations like the League of Women Voters, the United Nations and the United Nations Organization, and the public universities. With all of these institutions under siege, our task is not to defend them at all costs, but to ensure that their spirit can live on, if need be, in new forms. We can do this by making the institutional resources we currently enjoy fully available to the young. A paradox of the current global rebellion against institutions is that it is mostly a rebellion of the old. Young voters in the United Kingdom did not vote for Brexit, and young voters in the United States do not support dismantling public education, repealing the Affordable Care Act, or closing our nation's doors to immigrants and refugees. The young know that the well-being of all depends on the depth of our commitment to the most vulnerable. But many of the young do not trust the institutions that were created by their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. Many young people don't trust a federal government that has continually cut welfare programs while sending young people to die in fruitless wars. They don't trust police departments that allow the killing of young people with black or brown skin. They don't trust political parties that have sold themselves to Wall Street. And many young people don't trust the churches. Now, it's obvious this morning that there are many young people here in Colorado and the Rocky Mountains who do love your churches. But I bet you have friends who are powerful activists, strong social idealists, who would never set foot in a church. And so many young people today find it hard to trust either the conservative churches that stigmatize queer and trans people or the liberal churches that can feel like social clubs for their parents' generation. All this distrust can add up to a lack of engagement. Fewer than a third of adults under 30 attend religious services regularly, and only half of them voted in the last fall's election. If James Luther Adams was right about congregations as laboratories for democracy, these statistics have a lot to do with each other. When young people experience our congregations as unwelcoming or unappealing, the consequences filter into our politics. The challenge, then, is to open the doors of our churches to the young, as this church has been doing this weekend, not only by making them feel welcome at worship, not only by supporting youth cons, but by supporting whatever religious or spiritual or political or community-building projects they might devise. It can start as simply as a Black Lives Matter sign or a public expression of support for the water protectors at Standing Rock. Since everyone knows that those movements were initiated by young people of color, the public support of mostly older, mostly white Unitarian Universalists signal an openness to transfer some of those institutional resources. But signaling openness is just the start. The next step involves an actual commitment of our wealth, our time, and our physical space. The current national crisis is an opportunity for churches to become everyday organizing centers for any group that feels a need to organize. And Gretchen tells me this is exactly what your congregation has done, opening your doors to lots of new groups that are crystallizing in this very dangerous political moment. The point is not that if people come to an organizing meeting in the church, they might join the congregation. The point is that the congregation has an obligation to use its resources to renew the public sphere. When we turn our congregations into organizing centers and seedbeds of new institutions, sooner or later, we may find ourselves on the receiving end of the kind of violence that is constantly directed against young Black and brown bodies, against queer and trans bodies, Muslim and immigrant bodies in the United States and around the world. This has happened many times before. When the murders in the 1950s and 60s of Jimmie Lee Jackson and Medgar Evers and James Chaney and Denise McNair and Carol Robertson and Cynthia Wesley and Addie Mae Collins and so many other Black freedom fighters finally inspired Unitarian Universalists to join Martin Luther King in the Selma March of 1965, two of those Unitarian Universalists, James Reeb and Viola Liozzo, lost their lives in the struggle. When our congregation in Knoxville, Tennessee, about a decade ago, became known as a place that would stand with the victims and survivors of domestic violence, one perpetrator of that violence took out his rage in a shooting rampage that killed two parishioners. And that same violence is happening now. My former student and Sean's classmate, Skylar Vogel, serves Fourth Universalist Church in New York City. When that congregation declared itself a sanctuary church, it was the victim of a hate crime. Vandals carved a swastika and an anti-Semitic message into their front door. But here's the beautiful thing about institutions. They have a remarkable capacity to blunt the forces of violence. The knives and bullets that so easily pierce the flesh of the young, the poor, and the marginalized, sometimes slow to a stop when they hit the solid oak of a church door. Fourth Universalist had the connections to sponsor a public forum on anti-Semitism featuring city officials, leading rabbis, and even journalist Bill Moyers. Likewise, the presence of so many church people at Selma motivated the passage of the Voting Rights Act in a way that, tragically, a century of lynchings and racist violence had failed to do. In every movement for social justice, institutions have an important, but not an especially illustrious, role to play. Movements usually begin with the courageous witness of a single individual, often someone who is a direct victim of violence. It might be someone escaping from slavery, refusing to take the back seat on a bus, or speaking out against the hydroelectric dam that threatens her village in Guatemala. It is all too easy for the forces of violence to murder such prophetic individuals. But when an institution takes the side of the oppressed, the work of violence becomes more difficult. There's little heroism in being such an institution. Mostly, the heroism belongs to the individuals who speak out first. But the institutional role is important all the same. That's why I'm so excited by the current trend for cities, schools, and churches to declare themselves sanctuaries for immigrants and refugees. Obviously, these declarations involve risk. The risk of losing federal funding, the risk of harassment by immigration enforcement officials, the risk of the sort of violence that happened at Fourth Universalist. No institution should declare itself a sanctuary without a clear-eyed look at the risks. But the risks are tiny compared to the risks faced by refugees and immigrants themselves. The risks they faced in escaping from war or gang violence or poverty, the risk they face now of being separated from their families, locked up in a for-profit prison, or returned to a country of origin where they may not even speak the language. With every new institution that declares itself a sanctuary, the risk goes down because it spreads out a little bit more. The city where I live, Somerville, Massachusetts, declared itself a sanctuary several years ago. Our community has thrived on the creativity of immigrants from Brazil, Haiti, and Central America, as well as of students from every country in the world. When our mayor reaffirmed our identity as a sanctuary city a few months ago, he placed a big banner on our high school, just across from the Black Lives Matter banner on City Hall. He invited us all to a celebration that was really a pep rally for civic pride. We had food, we had dancing, we had fun speakers. For me and my spouse and my daughter, it was the easiest thing in the world to walk two short blocks and join the party. Ironically, it was not quite as easy, it was a little bit riskier for our immigrant neighbors to participate, since no sanctuary city can 100% guarantee the safety of its immigrants. But our easy and joyful action did make life just a little bit easier for our immigrant neighbors, who sensed that both we and our city's bureaucracy would do our best to stand between them and immigration enforcement. We took the sort of civic boosterism that is often exploited by fascists, and we turned it instead to the work of justice. So the work of blessing the world through institutions is not work for saints or heroes. It's not work for people who are eager to make it into the history books. Even if this congregation continues to do everything it's doing now and more, it will probably not get top billing when historians tell the story of how the people of the early 21st century turned back a tide of racism and nationalism and created new institutions to spread generosity and cooperation. Top billing will go to Black Lives Matter and the Water Protectors and the Dreamers, and that's where it belongs. Your institutional task as a church is easier than theirs, and your reward will be simply this. You might get invited to the party. The work of blessing the world through our institutions is not work for heroes, but it is work for lovers. I said at the beginning that Unitarian Universalism is a movement of people who love institutions even against our better judgment. But we don't need to choose between our love and our judgment. When we open our institutions to the future, when we use our institutions to blunt the forces of violence, both our minds and our hearts will be able to say, Amen. And the generations that come after us will be able to fall just as deeply in love as we have. May it be so here and in the world.